This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Detroit. Hopeless, right?
Or close to it. I mean,
what is going on?
Anybody who can is getting out of the city, right?
Oh, yeah. They're making commercials with Eminem. There's nothing left, you know?
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, the Muammar Gaddafi of the education policy world, Liam Julian.
Well, Mike, how are you doing?
I'm well. Do you think that label is fair enough?
Fair enough, yeah.
I mean, you're a bit of an extremist.
Yeah,
you're
absolutely
a bomb thrower.
Oh, big time.
A martyr?
Yeah.
Or would like to die as one.
Yeah, right. So the last drop of blood, that's my sign off on the blog.
Yes. Your blog posts kind of ramble on sometimes.
Oh, they interminable blog posts, but nobody knows what I'm talking about. Condemning random people.
Yes.
Things like that. Yeah.
Yes, I like it very much. Yeah. Speaking of terrorists, somehow it's come up that I ended up, and I can't quite remember why, but telling Nico, who's 3.5, about Osama bin Laden. And now he wants to ask me about him all the time, about this bad guy who we can't find and who hides out in caves. And I'm starting to think that maybe I made a mistake by going there with a 3.5-year-old. But what do you think, Liam?
I don't know anything about parenting.
Okay. You usually have opinions on all kinds of things you don't know anything about.
Yeah, right. It's weird. Once I get in a room full of people, I have no opinions, but put me in front of a computer screen by myself in a corner and I'll just go off.
All right. Well, you can later blog about it.
I'll make a blog about it.
Irresponsible adults bringing this kind of thing into their 3-year-old's consciousness.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's lots going on. Let's get started. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly, and then we got Amber's Research Minute, and we have a fairly new segment, Liam. It's Chris's What's Up With That?
Is that from Saturday Night Live?
Well, yeah. Yeah, and if you listen to it, we actually steal their whole jingle, too.
Oh.
But we don't think they'd mind.
I'm sure they don't.
Yes. But we haven't heard from them yet. Okay, so Janie here to read the questions. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Question one. As we all know, there's unrest in the Midwest, with public employee unions, including teachers, protesting in Madison, Columbus, and elsewhere. Why is it so hard for reform-minded Democrats to choose sides?
So here's the deal, Liam. So we know what's going on in these cities. You've got Republican
governors. Where are these cities? Columbus, Madison?
The Midwest.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
All right. Yeah. All right. So there's all this unrest going on because governors are proposing in some states to end collective bargaining or to limit it quite dramatically. Certainly talk about severe cuts to education that's going to lead to layoffs, needing to give back some benefits, pensions, on and on and on. And these are all things on the whole that you hear reformers talking about in a positive way, at least saying, hey, we need to limit the teacher union power. We need to balance their power. We need to be able to lay off ineffective teachers. And yet you have a lot of Democrats out there in the reform camp who are very mealy-mouthed about this, saying, well, this is going too far. Or, these are the extremists that you've been having to worry about. These people are anti-teacher union, but not us. I mean, what do you think? Don't they need to just say, hey, this stuff is about pushing for reform, and whether you're either for it or you're against it?
Maybe. I mean, there might be a more nuanced way to look at it. I mean, certainly in Madison, you know, to strip all collective bargaining from these people. I mean, you wouldn't think that all Democrats would be for that, right? I mean,
well, okay, but let's talk. So you're going to strip many collective bargaining rights, not all, right, but many, from teachers.
Right, so. But I mean, basically, they're left with essentially nothing. It essentially turns the right to work kind of state, right, for
right.
teachers, essentially.
Right. But why would reformers of any political persuasion be against that when they know that teacher union power is so strong?
I think they see it as a political move, right? I think that what they're more concerned about is seeing this as a Republican push to limit all sorts of collective bargaining rights and sort of weaken unions across the board,
right?
Thereby weakening sort of the Democrats' sort of push for power. I know where you're going, but I mean, I see it much more as like a political issue.
All right, so you see it's all right. So their loyalty to being Democrats,
exactly,
as well as being reformers, and they're trying to say, well, there's some fine line here that we can weaken the teacher unions or we can balance their power, but we don't want to actually take away all of their.
Yeah, and you could have teachers making some concessions without sort of going whole hog, right? And I think that's where they're going.
Maybe. And that's the other thing. Of course, there's been a lot of discussion about this, that Governor Walker, he's been, you know, given give backs by the union saying, okay, you know, cut our salaries, cut our benefits. Right. We agree.
Right.
And he said, that's not enough.
Right.
And look, I think that the problem is, at least in education, at the local level, you have teacher unions bargaining with local school boards that in many cases they've elected and that they have huge influence over. And these local school boards have very few incentives not to just give them whatever they want.
Yeah.
And so they make promises that they can't afford, and then the taxpayers are on the hook for it.
Yeah. This is something, this is why public sector unions are such a problem, right?
Right.
You know, private sector unions can be problematic, but they don't generally have that much sort of pull over the people that they're bargaining with.
That's right. And at least, you know, look at cops or firemen. I mean, you still have firefighters, I should say. You still have similar issues, but, you know, they negotiate with the mayor.
Yeah.
They don't negotiate with these school boards that almost nobody actually votes for and that are controlled by the unions. Okay. Topic number two.
Detroit again shows itself to be the poster child of how not to run a school district. Its newest stopgap measure will increase high school class sizes to 60 and close half of the district schools. Are these really the only options?
I mean, what's going on there, Liam?
I mean, I have no idea. I read about this, and doesn't this just seem to you as if, this is just going to make fewer people want to have anything to do with Detroit Public Schools?
Well, it also makes me wonder if this is for real, right? I mean, really, 60 classes of 60? It sounds like the old Washington Monument strategy.
Right, right.
You know, the National Park Service says, well, if you cut our budget, we're going to have to shut down the Washington Monument, and then they get their money. The question is, you know, why has Detroit not been more successful in getting concessions from its teachers union? Understand that they've been, you know, holding fast to their current contract, not wanting to give back on pay, on benefits, and those sorts of things. And meanwhile, we're going to pass along to kids to have classes of 60. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, as Chris Irvine here has pointed out, from his days teaching in Michigan and having friends working in the Detroit schools, you know, they have the attendance rates are so low in a lot of these high schools that you may have 60 kids on the books and actually only maybe 30 kids on any given day.
Hmm.
And so perhaps might not be as outrageous as
it is. It's just a good way to put a positive spin on.
That's right.
Right. You know, but this might be an opportunity for Detroit to try to, you know, maybe experiment with some other sorts of things, right? So maybe some different choice alternatives for these kids, right? Instead of having classrooms of 60, maybe they just sort of expand sort of the opportunity where Detroit Public School kids can sort of not be stuck in Detroit Public Schools.
Liam, is it ever okay for us to just say, you know what, and something like this, it's hopeless?
Yeah, well, this is, I didn't want to say this, but I mean, really, I mean, Detroit, gosh, hopeless, right?
Or close to it. I mean,
what is going on?
I mean, anybody who can is getting out of the city, right?
Oh, yeah. They're making commercials with Eminem. I mean, it's a last, they've just, there's nothing left, you know?
That's pretty desperate right there.
It was rough. But I mean, seriously, with this, it just doesn't seem like this system is viable.
Right.
You know, I mean, the city as a whole isn't. I don't know. I mean, I just, that's why this story sort of just, it doesn't strike me one way or another as being.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let Detroit Public Schools go bankrupt. It can't get worse than this. Okay. Topic number three.
Michelle Rhee continues to get a lot of buzz, no pun intended, especially now that Richard Whitmire's book, The Bee Eater, is out. Liam, why do you hate her so?
Well, what is this? She ate a bee? What's this about the title of this book?
She was teaching.
She was teaching
as a TFA teacher,
right?
In a tough class. The kids were going crazy.
And so she
opened up the window and a bee flew in.
Yeah.
And she whacked it with a lesson plan, flicked it into her mouth and ate it. And all the kids were like, whoa.
Whoa, we better not mess with her?
Yeah, like this.
Like she's crazy?
She's crazy.
She eats bugs?
Yes, like we better. She's crazy.
First of all, I don't buy it. I think that's BS. I don't think she ate a bee. But anyway, and regardless, why do I hate Michelle Rhee? Well, since you posed the question that way, I just think Michelle Rhee is a zealot, you know, and I'm just sort of always suspicious of any sort of zealots. And
that kind of blows our whole Muammar Gaddafi analogy at the beginning of the show.
Good point. Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, that's a good point. But really, I mean, and no, I don't hate Michelle Rhee, nor do I hate the sort of reforms that she's pushing for. I think they're necessary. And I like her idea of, you know, starting this group to raise all this money to actually counteract the unions without, you know, not just ideas, but actually some dollars, you know. I don't like it, though, when I hear Michelle Rhee talking about this is a crisis, that's a crisis, the kids are dying and this and that, we have to help them and blah, blah, blah.
Right, right, right.
And
you know, I mean, she keeps saying, and this really drives me crazy, when people say, we know what works, we just don't have the political will to do it.
Yeah, right, that's another thing.
You know, to say that, well, it's not exactly that we have figured it out. And look, I mean, in D.C., you can point to some big improvements that happened in the city, but you certainly can't claim that she fixed the D.C.
No,
public schools.
No, and she got fired.
Right.
Right?
Well, all right.
Well, did she not?
Well, her boss got fired.
Her boss got fired, but she was one of the big reasons why. I think everybody agrees that with that. And she was out, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know.
So what can I
she's
do
She's like
get
the paragon
there?
Of success, but I don't know what she's actually done. You see, this happens all the time in politics, whether it's Sarah Palin or Barack Obama. Everybody puts all their hopes and dreams. Michelle Rhee is that of the education reform world. You know, she hasn't really done anything.
Well, now I think that's a little unfair, right?
She
closed 23 schools in D.C.
Oh, well,
she cleaned up the central office. She fired half the central office staff.
Okay.
She fired hundreds of teachers.
That's fine.
You know,
but now
people
what?
Get
now
textbooks
she's gone.
Get there on time.
Wow, she got the textbooks there on time. That's great. But I'm serious. She was only in this position for, 3 years?
Yeah.
Is that right?
About 3.5. Yeah.
3.5 years, and then that's it. I mean, and now she has, for some reason, been vaulted to the top of all of our hopes and dreams about education reform. What about somebody like Paul Vallis or somebody like that who's been doing this for a long, long time, you know? I mean, nobody ever was, you know, sort of put him on top of a pedestal.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
He's just not as interesting a character.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Okay, so it's not that she didn't do anything, but relatively speaking.
Okay. All right. Sounds like Liam does not hate Michelle Rhee. But he doesn't like her either. Okay, so that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. It's now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
We have a big night tonight.
We do.
Yes. We have the board. Thomas Befornham Institute's board is in town, and a few of us are going to have dinner with them.
Fancy dinner when the board's in town. Yeah. Gotta love it.
Yeah. We're going to P.J. Clark's, newly opened in Washington, D.C. I get to, I'm going to pretend that I'm Don Draper and, you know, order an old-fashioned. Very excited.
Nice.
All right. So what you got for us today?
All right. So many folks, as you know, complain that these charter studies that come out lump all the charters together and they don't really, you know, analyze them separately. So this week's study is conducted by our top-notch researchers. That would be Tom Kane, John Fullerton, and others. And they have taken a step, in my humble opinion, in the right direction by parsing effects for urban and non-urban charter schools. Study includes 22 oversubscribed charter schools and complements it with an observational study, which includes all middle and high school charters operating in the Bay State between 02 and 09. It finds that overall, charter middle schools boost average math scores but do little for average ELA scores. When parsed by urbanicity, however, the results get a little more intriguing. Urban middle schools show large positive effects on ELA scores, while non-urban middle schools have zero to negative impact on both ELA and math. This is important. Differences in impact, can I talk, among urban and non-urban charters do not appear to be due to student demographics, at least not entirely. I think I'm losing my audience, so real quickly. Urban charters do well with minority and low-income students, which they have more of, but they do moderately well for white students. Non-urban middle schools fail to show gains for any demographic subgroup. Researchers say something about the schools themselves is driving the large urban charter gains.
You don't say.
Yeah. So they surveyed surveyed principals, which I thought was great because sometimes we don't do that. Just a couple of the quick findings. Urban schools have longer school days, spend twice as much time on language and math instruction, and are more likely to identify with a no excuses approach to education.
Come on.
A lot.
I know, but this is not a surprise. We knew from the federal charter study that came out last year found that middle class middle school charter middle schools did not show much gains, but low income ones did. And it was obvious why. If you are in a suburban affluent community and you start up a charter school, it is because you don't want your kid going to the traditional public school where they focus on testing. Mm-hmm. You want to send them to some progressive or Waldorf or, you know, new agey school instead. And lo and behold, those schools don't have good test scores.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess I just missed your larger point, but I mean, they do look at the types of kids that are being enrolled in these schools.
Right.
So the non-urban, I mean, you got the same type of kid in both schools.
Well, then what are the distinction then? I mean, urban versus non-urban. I mean, I'm assuming that the suburban schools do have different demographics, though they look at see how the you know, say the poor kids in those
schools.
Right,
but they looked at peer effects. I mean, they actually did and found like very little could be explained by peer effects.
Well, I'm just assuming that the urban schools are probably schools that, like you said, are back to basics, no excuses. We're going to try to drive achievement up.
Mm-hmm.
And that most that I know of, that suburban charter schools that I know of tend to be more on the progressive side. They basically say, we don't care about test scores as much. You know, we care about other things. That's how we're attracting families to our schools. And if they don't care about getting test scores up as much, test scores aren't going to go up as much.
Perhaps. I don't know. It's a reasonable theory. But I actually think, I mean, to me, the value add was actually the survey piece, you know, because I think we have these sort of ideas that this is how it works. Like, you know, you got these theories and it sounds reasonable. But yeah, I mean, some of these theories actually hold up when you actually survey these people, and they do are spending more time on these things, and they are have this no excuses mentality. So to me, anytime you can have a study that actually, you know, nicely confirms what we think anecdotally, that's a pretty that's a valuable study.
I mean, look, we've parsed, I feel like we've gotten to the point where we have parsed this charter school thing every which way we possibly can, right? Yeah. I mean, and which is fine. I mean, a few years ago, there was a feeling that we didn't know much about charter school
achievement. Right, used to lump them all together.
Yeah, so now we know.
And I remember that. That's did the typology. Remember that?
That's right.
Separating charter schools because people didn't know.
Yeah, different kinds.
Different kinds of charter schools.
Yeah, and we just, you know, I mean, we come back to the same thing over and over and over again. Some are good, some are bad. You know, and so it just depends. I mean, this all comes, this is why at the end this is not an empirical question about whether or not to support charter schools. It comes down to politics. Yeah, it comes down, you know, what is your appetite for taking some risk with public dollars and being willing to say, you know what, we're going to take a bet on some nonprofit group to run a school, and it could go really well, it could go really bad. But we think that's valuable versus just saying we're going to have a traditional standards system in standardized system where, you know, it probably won't go really well and probably won't go really bad. It'll just be mediocre.
Yeah, I mean, you know, though, what charter school opponents would say about that.
Can't be guinea pigs.
Well, no, but they would say that Mike is saying that it's not an empirical question because maybe the empirical evidence doesn't support what Mike would want it to.
Yeah, I think they say, oh, we don't want to treat our kids like guinea pigs. We can't take risk in education.
You think we should treat our kids like guinea pigs?
Yeah, no. I'm just saying, it's hype. I mean,
I am pro treating kids like guinea pigs, absolutely. And hey, look, I would say this. The empirical evidence is that the best urban schools in America today are charter schools, you know, but so are the worst urban schools in America today. So, you know, we know the empirical evidence says there's a lot of, it's mixed. And it depends if you're willing to take the good with the bad. All right, yeah, so what song goes
mixed word, like people hate that, but that is the most accurate word for charter research.
Absolutely. Okay.
So any excuse to play Boston, we take it. So this is just that. We have Rock and Roll Band by Boston.
It's time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
Woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that? What up with that? Yes,
Chris, welcome back to the show. What you got for us this week?
The big news out of North Carolina this month, ignoring for the moment school board action effectively ending desegregation in the Wake County schools, comes out of Rockingham County, where the Board of Education has approved a ban on the use of corporal punishment. Accordingly, a congratulations is in order. That is, if you believe Rockingham should be congratulated for joining the rest of us here in the 21st century. It took until 2011 for these folks to ban corporal punishment. What's up with that? Naturally, the motion passed by the slimmest possible margin, a 6-5 vote among school board members. One even went as far as saying, quote, if it wasn't for corporal punishment, I wouldn't be here. Here as in still alive? Here as in the United States? More likely here as in a 2011 school board meeting arguing to continue using violence as punishment in public schools. He goes on to say, quote, I learned how to beg in a principal's office. But we live in a much more complicated time. If by a much more complicated time he means a time when hitting children is not socially acceptable, then sure, let's call it a much more complicated time. The reality of it is that people like this have refused to come to grips with any form of social progress in their lifetimes, from gender equality to civil rights. It's unfortunate that they're in control of school districts across the country, including 57 in North Carolina, where corporal punishment is still allowed. But thank God for the North Carolinians who have come to their senses and changed these archaic disciplinary guidelines. One middle school teacher told the board that corporal punishment seems to be at odds with our goal of creating a safe learning environment. Seems to be at odds, huh? You think?
Wow. I mean, so Chris, not only going out hard against corporal punishment, but basically saying that if you favor corporal punishment, you're also sexist and racist at the same time.
It's a big statement.
He's going to stand by it. All right. Liam, what do you think? Should we be hitting kids in school?
I don't know. You'd have to take a look at the empirical evidence.
was that a good one?
I wonder, though. I wonder if you could take a look at these districts where they're still hitting kids, if discipline is much stricter and they have less instances of kids acting out. I don't know.
Right. And does the discipline spike right before the state test is mandated? I don't know.
Yeah.
There have been studies actually shown that the schools that allow corporal punishment, the students on average have lower IQs and perform poorly on test scores in comparison to their non-corporal punishment.
Oh, they're getting
peers.
Hit in the head too much.
Exactly. That's obvious. Oh, come on. That's a causation correlation thing. We don't know which is which.
True.
But you know, this is one of these questions of local control, right? We've stripped school districts of many of their authorities over things that really matter, like the standards kids are held to. So you say, well, what are we going to leave to local level? And if you're, I suspect these are mostly rural counties where people want corporal punishment in the schools. And, maybe this is one of these things where we say, hey, that's up to you. We want to use the power of persuasion to convince you that might be a bad idea. But I don't know that we want to have a state law or a federal law saying you can't do it.
That you can't beat kids in schools.
Well, within certain guidelines. I mean, there's a line, right? There's a line. No, I'm serious. I mean, look, there's corporal punishment and then there's child abuse. And I think that people do draw lines between one and the other. I'm not saying I'm in for it. I think everybody should get rid of it. But I'm also saying that, look, maybe this is something that is legitimate to leave to local communities to decide.
It's true. One adamant school board member actually argued to change the policy where parents have to be present when the corporal punishment is administered.
Hmm. You would wonder why the parent can just administer it. Maybe they're enfeebled parents or something. If a parent is unable or unwilling to administer the corporal punishment, the school can.
They could have a school-appointed corporal punisher that could, come home in this.
Could wear that sort of that black, hood, with the eye slits and come in.
Liam, these are the great ideas we come up with when you're on the show.
Yeah.
I love it. All right. Well, Chris, what's up with that? All right. Thanks so much. Liam, so much. Really appreciate you joining us today. So nice to see you.
Pleasure.
It's always a shot in the arm to us here.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Oh,
yeah.
That's wow.
Yeah.
Thanks.
It's true.
Nice to know.
All right. Good. We'll be back with Rick Hess next week, I think. Until then.
I'm Liam Julian.
I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.